Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly fascinating, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm happy to say we have Lance Blythe on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, Chiricahua and Janos, Communities of Violence in the Southwestern Borderlands, 1680 to 1880. Lance, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Certainly. I am a PhD in history, working on primarily trained in colonial Mexico and northern Mexico and U.S. Southwest. I call myself a borderlander now. I am employed as the command historian for North American Aerospace Defense Command and U.S. Northern Command, and a number of your listeners probably know NORAD, as it's called, which is a binational command with the responsibilities for aerospace warning, aerospace control, and maritime warning for North America around the United States and Canada. We're coming up on our 55th year of that alliance and working together. And also, I'm dual-hatted as the command historian for U.S. Northern Command, which is a geographical combatant command. The United States has one of six of them, and we're responsible for homeland defense, civil support, and security cooperation in an area of responsibility that includes the United States, Canada, Mexico, the Bahamas, and which also includes Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, but not Hawaii, which belongs to another command. And so with that in mind, I will make the point that all opinions I state here are my own, are no way represent the official position of NORAD, U.S. Northern Command, the Canadian Ministry of National Defense, the U.S. Department of Defense, or either the government of either country, Canada or the United States.
I imagine you have a little note card in front of you that says, say this.
Yeah, well, those are things we try to make very clear whenever we do talk.
And so you were in the service before you were in the service, so to say.
Yes. So I am a civilian employee of the Department of Defense. I graduated from undergrad in 1988, went on an extended study break in the Marine Corps in 1993, Gulf War, LA riots, came back to grad school in 1993, coming up on 20 years, oh my lord, just basically had no idea what I was going to do, but thought this would be a good chance to have a break, and got my master's. I always say I crammed a two-year program into 4 years, and then after that, I ended up going on to grad school and for a PhD, vaguely aware there were historians in the federal government, never really pursuing it, and then kind of stumbled into the opportunity about the time I was finishing my dissertation to go to work for the Department of Air Force as a historian. In large part, I was happy to do it because it allowed me to stay out west where I've grown up in the area. Nothing against other parts of the country, but I just find them too green and too humid.
Yeah, right.
For my living, so I started working down in Albuquerque initially.
Yeah.
For a few years, and then came up here about 5 years ago, and been the command historian for about a year now. So
yeah.
It's good work for a historian. I'm dealing with the present, which is interesting for someone who overwhelmingly prefers to study the past. So
That's interesting. I imagine they just love you being ex-military and then having a PhD. And
it did make the hiring process a lot easier.
Yeah, I imagine it did. Yeah, and I also like what you said about the extended sort of, what did you call it?
Oh, an extended study break.
Study break, yeah. I always tell people that if they're thinking about a gap year, they should make it a gap 4 years.
Oh, certainly.
Just join the military. Yeah. Get paid while you're screwing around.
Yeah.
So I don't know about screwing around, but
there's a lot of that. Trust me.
Yeah, I mean, I know that there is. Yeah, but it is a good opportunity for a lot of young people. I know that
yes,
for a fact.
Yes,
it definitely is. So
no, I don't regret it whatsoever.
Yeah. So tell us how you came to write this book.
I came to write the book really out of two impeti. The first is one I think will be very familiar to a number of your listeners, and that is by the time I was finishing my dissertation, I was sick and tired of the dissertation. I didn't want to deal with it. I wrote it primarily on the Presidio of Janos, looking at them, and I was tired of it, and I did not want to just turn that into a book. I felt I was in a lot of intellectual dead ends, et cetera, et cetera. So that fact, combined with the fact that I went to work for the federal government, where I did not have to enter into the publish or perish world where I did not have to have a book. Anyways, freed me up to do the book that I wanted to do. So I gave it about a year thinking about what I had. And the Air Force gave me a lot of time to do that because they deployed me overseas for 4 months and as a historian in theater. And so I had a lot of time to think about that. And then on the 17-hour plane flight back, I started sketching out what I thought were the interesting things. And what I thought I had interesting was this idea of violence, that really was the central nugget. And that's how I then pursued working on the book, taking what I had learned from my dissertation, taking what we know about the Chiricahua Apache, who were very well studied by the anthropologists who were doing at the time what they thought was salvage anthropology, trying to collect all these things in the 1920s before people disappeared. That, of course, did not happen. But put those two together around this idea of violence.
Mm-hmm. So the area that we're talking about, just to situate it on a map, is what is today eastern Arizona, western New Mexico, and then some of the area of a state in Mexico that I don't remember the name of.
Northwestern Chihuahua and northeastern Sonora. So right around the boot heel of New Mexico, that area right down in the vicinity there.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking, again, to sort of put it in, again, now in ethnographic context, we're talking about the coming together, to use a kind of neutral phrase, of two different sorts of people. And one is Hispanic people, and the other are these are basically Native Americans, these Chiricahua Apaches. So let's begin the story by asking how they got there to this really kind of remote area.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, if the Janos really is founded in the mid-1680s, and it is founded primarily by refugees from the New Mexico Revolt, Pueblo Revolt in New Mexico 5 years prior. That is, in 1680, the Pueblo Indians rose up, drove out the Spanish who had been there since about 1610 or so, and those folks retreated down to El Paso, down into, at that time, the province of Nueva Vizcaya, today the state of Chihuahua, and many of them stayed, and many of them ended up going over where there was water. As you pointed out in your opening remarks, it's a very dry area, so there was water over a place called Casas Grandes, and land, so they could farm and survive. You had to grow your own food, and in doing that, put pressures on the local Indians. Suma Hokome Hano Indians were the other group there, and another rebellion, as the Spanish saw it, an uprising or a resistance, as the Native people saw it, broke out. And in response to that, there was a decision to put together a permanent military garrison or presidio. And obviously, there are presidios. San Francisco is the most famous one, but there are presidios in Tucson. There are presidios in Santa Fe, San Antonio to this day. Those are towns in the U.S. that were presidio communities to begin with. Mm-hmm. And so they were founded there, and that is Janos. Chiricahua are a group that of Athapascan peoples, Athapascan-speaking peoples, and they all begin to migrate down sometime 1200 of the Common Era. They come south, work through how and when and where, we're still not sure, but by roughly 1500, just before they get there, there's very clear there are Apache and peoples on the southern plains, and they split into a couple groups. Navajo and really Apache are the two large groups that come out of that. And this group of Apaches that would become Chiricahua had moved south, had moved over across the Rio Grande during the course of the 17th century. And when the Spanish left, well, they had been in the horse raiding and trading business with their plains cousins. And so they, in many ways, followed farther south to go continue on this relationship, often violent, sometimes not, with the Hispanic settlers. And so both by roughly 1700 are living roughly in the same areas, and the people become known as Chiricahua, settle around a mountain range that the Spanish called Chiricagui, which I understand is Opata, Indian word for the wild turkeys, and so that's the Spanish name, typically named Indian groups by the mountain range. They seem to be at the center of their territory, even if it was or wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit, let's put it further in context about what I guess I might call life ways. The Chiricahua, they were did they practice agriculture? Were they pastoral nomads? Did they deal entirely in trading? How did they make their living? How did they live?
Well, the Chiricahua, incredibly flexible. I mean, they would do whatever they needed to do to survive. As you pointed, the Southwest, it is a relatively rough terrain. Chiricahua were very flexible. They undoubtedly farmed. There's just too many references to cornfields, for example, mm-hmm. in Spanish documents. Now, what they probably didn't do is they did not stay put. And so what they would do is in the spring, they would be down in lower, and they would have set out the winter in the lower elevations where it was warmer. They would move into an area where the rains would come and the water would come, and they would plant their plants, corn, probably squash also. And then as it warmed up down below, they would just leave and move up into the higher country. So they would exploit the entire ecological zone where they would hunt and gather and do what else they did. And as they gathered and made a surplus, they would make caches all over the country so they could mm-hmm. get to those things later. And then as the winter came, they would move back to lower ground. So the women did a lot of the gathering, probably the agriculture. The men did a lot of the hunting, but very marginal terrain. Not a lot of give in the system, and so the opportunity to go get valuable items from one's neighbors was very strong. And indeed, mm-hmm. the Chiricahua the tales they told were very very clear. They tell how they came to be, that their cultural and hero, Child of the Water, got to select. There were two mountains. Got to select where Apaches would live, and he chose this very barren one, but it was recognized. We had wild turkeys on it and pinion tree, you know, pinion nut trees, and okay, I recognize that. I know how to live there. The other, his kin of some sort, maybe brother, maybe uncle, we're not sure, but killer of the enemies, as he was called, was. He chooses, gets the other mountain, but then he opens it up, and out comes cattle and horses and all these good things. And so basically by that, it's that the Europeans kind of cheated mm-hmm. and had things that they didn't. So kind of going and getting them was an acceptable way. And raiding was an economic activity. If you needed something and if you don't have a lot of give, then you do go and you would go raid for that. And that, mm-hmm. what is the irony thing of, on the backside of that is Hanos, like most of northern Mexico, were, the Hispanics practice an agro-pastoralism in which they would intensely farm the bottom lands and then let horses and cattle pretty much run wild on the mountainside, mm-hmm. on the hills around. And so there was a lot of things to go get that were not terribly well guarded, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that were very important to the Hispanics. So both were, in many ways, living in a very, very resource not a lot of resources to be had, and both typically trying to use the same land in the same way in many cases, and that may be a basis of some of the conflict that occurred.
Before we move on from ethnography, the Chiricahua, by this time, these Apaches were a thoroughly equine culture. They had had horses for a long time, and they thought of having horses as completely
right. Natural. Yeah, horses. Yeah, they had definitely had them from the 17th century. Mm-hmm. And what's going on in the late 17th century, 1680s, 1690s, is another group, the Shoshone Comanche, are pushing into the southern plains. They are definitely equine. They are definitely raiding, and so the plains Apaches need horses to fight back. They're getting those from raids on the Spanish settlements.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
And they're that's when the Spanish move south, that there goes that resource they need to have. And so Apaches were certainly, yeah, they were, horses were important. Horses were the critical bride price. Horses were a critical tool. They were also a critical food source. Mm-hmm. Apaches were very a very flexible people, very willing to eat horses. And, mm-hmm. There is I don't know which John Wayne movie it is, but there's this, where he's talking about that, a white man will ride a horse and give it up, then the Mexican will ride it while longer, then a Comanche will ride it while longer, then an Apache will come ride it more and then eat it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's John Wayne, but it's probably relatively accurate.
Yeah, sure.
In the depiction of the time.
Sure. And then one more question about the Chiricahua. There were Indians in the neighborhood, or Native Americans, as we should say, in the neighborhood that built cities. The Chiricahua did not do that.
That is correct. Yeah, these were very much a nomadic people. They did move through the time. They moved in when they moved into the area of the Southwest that we're referring to, Northern Mexico, U.S. Now Northern Mexico, U.S. Southwest. There were Udo Aztecan speaking peoples already there. I mentioned the Hokami, the Suma, Opara, and these were far more subtle peoples who farmed. Lived in relatively large villages and farmed, mm-hmm. and so were, could be missionized. You could put a mission, a church in the middle of their village and begin to turn them into some version of Spaniards. You didn't have that with the various Apache peoples.
Yeah, yeah. And then one more note about the Janos. This notion of the Presidio, I didn't know about it actually, but it has a resonance for somebody that studies early Russian history. When the Russians planted a community out there on the steppe, it was always a fort. It had a stockade. There was no question about it. That's the way they built these settlements. And so were the Spanish actively involved in building these things, or were they sort of volunteer communities and then the Spanish had to go out and protect them, which was sort of the American or the British experience, that the British could never control settlements and people would go out and then they'd have to protect them and, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, this was far more along the lines of the Russian version, where this was an assigned, the company was recruited. Mm-hmm. Had a captain and lieutenants and a certain number of troops. They were recruited and paid by the state and sent, you know, you will live there and you will bring your families there and you will, that's where you will live. And sometimes they were built as forts. More often than not, they were just built as the houses all facing each other, kind mm-hmm. of typical what we see today, New Mexico Plaza, mm-hmm. where the houses wouldn't have, the homes would all be next to each other. They wouldn't have any, all the windows would face the plaza, and the outside mm-hmm. would be blank. Mm-hmm. But it was far more that directed settlements that you would find. And the experience actually comes from Presidios apparently come from the Spanish experience in North Africa in the 16th century, where they see some towns and some places, and now they have to defend them. Mm-hmm. They would tell a garrison troops, Spanish troops, go live there, mm-hmm. and that's where they came from. Presidio and later on in Mexican history became used, and Spanish history became used for prisons, and sometimes the two get confused. But when you're talking about northern Mexico, Presidio is referring to a garrison community of folks who lived there, were sent there, lived there, and usually recruited from there as time went on.
Mm-hmm. So is it proper to say then that Janos is kind of the aftermath of a failed colonization effort? Because, they basically escaped, I mean,
and most of them chose not to go back. New Mexico's reconquered in the 1690s, but a lot of the original colonists chose not to go back with that reconquest.
Mm-hmm.
It's people who had to flee from one uprising, found themselves causing another. So their mindset was, their initial mindset, though, that first generation was probably not very forgiving.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. Who was the nominal authority in this area? Was it the Spanish crown?
The Spanish crown, yes. There was a governor in Chihuahua, the Ciudad Chihuahua, and then, of course, that becomes the state as time goes on. And then there's a captain and military commander who has really has that combination of civil and military powers. There is a civil authority, but it's always relatively weak and far more dependent upon the military authority mm-hmm. than you would find elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Before we go to violence, how did these communities, I'm sure they did, I know the answer to this question, how did they mix other than fighting?
And I think that's a very good question, a very good point that has to be made, is that they did have a large number of exchanges between them. They humans, again, I point out this is a very, as you point out, this is a resource-limited environment. And in that, if someone has something you need and you can get it by trading for it, you probably will do that, not take the risk of just going and take it. So there was a large amount of trading that did go on. It probably on a very personal level, work back and work where the folks would trade, foodstuffs especially would be traded. The Apache would trade back horses or hides or skins for use. As time goes on, different time periods, there were long periods of time in the late 18th and early 19th century where both communities lived relatively peaceably alongside each other and did do exchanges through trade. And as I'm sure we'll talk about, both were probably genetic related because they did exchange unwillingly in most mm-hmm. cases population with each other. Mm-hmm. But that is the ultimate resource in these environments is people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's true in the Russian case as well. A lot of people don't understand this, that Russia is very large, but at least in the early modern period, it was very poorly populated. So the valuable commodity was people. And mm-hmm. the state made sure that its people were where it wanted them to be in the right concentrations so that they could tax them. They didn't want them wandering around.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then one more question before we actually get to the narrative itself about religion. Were the Spanish, did they intend to convert these people? Did they try? How much emphasis do they put on it?
There's always... In the earlier periods, there is always that desire to missionize, to turn these people into Christians. And as you know, in the early modern period, people didn't usually refer to themselves in nationalistic terms, but rather religious ones.
Mm-hmm.
So if you'd ask the Janeros, people who lived in Janos around 1700, what are you? They probably would have said Christian. They probably would have responded with that. And so getting people to be Christian was a central part of making them good Spanish subjects. That was always the desire, but it was very difficult to implement with people who were not settled.
Right.
And there was no way to missionize, no way to put it. And so it was, you see back and forth between, set a good example and they will become Christian and, treat them with kindness and so forth. And so that desire to Christianize was there. It really steadily seeps away as the 18th century goes. And so by the end of the 18th century, you have basically instructions saying, look, keep the priests away from the Apaches.
Mm-hmm.
They're just causing problems.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have them. Don't try to missionize them. Don't try to convert them. Just leave them alone.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, that becomes the... I think that was just final official recognition of the reality that just probably wasn't something that was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if the people of Janos looked at the Chiricahua and sort of saw them through a religious lens, that is, they were heathens, that they're to be converted at least until the 18th century, can we say anything about the way the Chiricahua saw the people of Janos?
I think what there is a great story that Chiricahua told of how people came to be, and that the Creator makes one group of people that are Apache, He makes another that are white people, and are Chiricahua and not Chiricahua. And He basically says, okay, Chiricahua, you will live here. White people, you will live way over there. Whenever you see each other, you will fight.
Hmm.
And I think that's you have a small group of people who have undergone couple centuries worth of migration south through lands and time, so they're very wary, and understandably so.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they were always prepared, and typically looked on. I think they looked up on Janos and up the Mexicans really as another food resource, as another resource in their life survival, especially by the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
They're very clear talking to the Americans that, these are our ranches down here. We go down and we ranch the Mexicans. We get what we want from them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was always the ongoing problem for U.S. Apache policy, which I didn't cover in the book because want to get into all of that.
Right.
I think on the individual level, they did see each other. They did, but on a larger, I guess, civilizational level, they both sides saw they were quite different,
mm-hmm.
and didn't pursue too close of a connection.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's actually start talking about violence then. In the book, you talk about various moments at which the violence is more intense and less intense. Could we begin with the earliest one?
Certainly, I think the first really intense one are those the first years of the late 17th century. A number of listeners may know that the 1680s were a very there was a large crisis all across northern New Spain. Pueblo Revolt comes in. they know, the Spanish know the French are looking for the mouth of the Mississippi. De La Salle misses it and goes to Texas, but they're worried about that. So there is a large amount of defensive expansion. This is when the Spanish take Texas. That's why they retake New Mexico. So on that very official level, there's a lot of concern, and that's why Janos comes into being. That's another military force. And so it is a time of pacification, of where you have large groups of the original Indian inhabitants, Hano, Holcome, Suma, and then you have the Apaches migrating in, who are incorporating those and finding their ways forward. So this is at the first period of violence that comes and goes as it goes forward, but pretty much it probably hits a what we would call a steady state, if you want that, by the middle of the 18th century, where both sides are small scale but persistent raiding of livestock, but also of people. And this is where the evidence is the strongest for that exchange of people, where Apaches would definitely take local Indians. There's good genetic evidence of a lot of the mothers in those first generations were Indian women from other communities, mm-hmm. other Indian communities, possibly ones who had been in revolt in which the men had been killed. So mm-hmm. That was a way to, for the women and their families to survive, was to attach themselves to the Apaches, and also unquestionably through raiding and back and mm-hmm. forth. And on the Spanish side, parish records are where we see that, where you see Apaches being baptized, mm-hmm. and you can follow them being raised up to the community, having children, and then disappearing into the community, where, I said, by the mid-18th century, if you run the genetics, there would have been a lot of shared markers between the two.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I
was going to say, maybe we should talk a little bit about the genetic evidence, because I think a lot of people don't know that, to a certain degree, this sort of thing, this sort of borderlands history and the history of the mixing of people has kind of been revolutionized by modern genetics. And we're not talking about, this isn't the scary kind of genetics. This is the kind of genetics that just says who your people are. That's all. It's just kind of a fingerprint.
Yeah. Right, and the evidence sometimes is from mitochondrial DNA, which is passed along through mothers, uh-huh. relatively unchanging. And in any genetic population, there is a set of I am no expert in genetics, but a set of markers that you associate with different areas of regional areas of such as there are markers associated with Europe, there are markers associated with Africa, markers associated with Asia. And
I was going to say, I've studied this quite extensively, I think the proper way to make people understand it is it defines your descent group, not your race or anything like that. Yes. It's like, this is probably where your people came from.
Right.
And so when you see like the mitochondrial DNA or the Y chromosome, which is another way to trace it, mm-hmm. you can see when there's been some sort of, we'd call it interbreeding or intermixing.
Right.
And this is true in the Russian case as well. We can tell, for example, a little bit about how the Russians intermingled with Finnish people. For example, this is one of the mysteries of early Russian history. To what extent did the incoming Slavs mix with the Finns? And so we know that, now. We couldn't know it before. There's some evidence that you can point to in terms of linguistics, like, there'd be words that enter the vocabulary, and that suggests a certain amount of mixing. But this is even better evidence that there was actual genetic mixing of some sort. And as you say, the thing that makes it a little bit – it kind of takes your breath away a little bit is that in many cases this was not voluntary.
Yes, right. And that's – and here I'm following a lot of work by James Brooks, for example, on slavers and captives. And when we talk about – and I haven't really used those words, but I've been dancing around them. We are talking about captivity. We are talking about slavery, but we're talking about a kinship sort of slavery, where the captive is – someone is captured as a child, raised up in that community, thinks of themselves as a member of that community, even if on the lower rungs. They may be raised as a servant in a household or what have you. They're not able to escape. They lose all those contacts that they had in their other one and go from there. And both sides were very, both communities, I think, clearly did this. The Apache were probably far more, again, they needed people, so they were very willing to take people from the outside and bring them in, and mm-hmm. and often, many of these, eventually, it just wouldn't matter where you had come from for on the Apache side. Spanish side had a very nice caste system of gradients, and in theory, if you were someone who had a mixed descent, you would be belonged here. But as people got status and got promoted, they were able to start claiming, "Oh no, I'm Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
That's my descent group is Spanish." And so forth. So, yes, it's very slippery evidence, but I think it's just more evidence that human beings migrate and they interbreed.
Mm-hmm.
We've discovered Neanderthal DNA now.
Sure,
DNA. Actually, so it goes way back.
Yeah, I actually know the guy that did that research.
Wow.
Yeah, no, I did. I used to hang out a little bit in his lab in Boston, and they discovered this. Yes, but it's actually very interesting, because it's very interesting evidence in the sense that you can tell when certain groups mixed and to what extent they mixed. And this solves a lot of problems, which we see hinted at in other evidence, for example, in the evidence of texts or in the evidence of existing language today. It's not 100% certain, but it's certainly suggestive of certain patterns of activity. And, one of the ones you mentioned is, and this you see in a lot of places that are borders or have been raided, is that the women tend to be taken and the men tend to be killed.
Yes. And I think that, and that's the, you're right, this genetic evidence that I only just used a small part of, but I'm also quite interested in it, shows us that this intermixing is quite normal, quite natural, happens.
Yeah.
And that's a plus thing. In our multicultural world, we tend to look at that and think, oh, that's great. But we also have to remember there's a dark side to that, that it often was forced.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I'm wondering when the Apaches raided, they would raid a community, and they would attempt to take the livestock, let's say, or take horses or whatever they were going to take, and they were also going to raid for people. How did the Spanish authorities react, and how did the locals did the locals call for help, and did the Spanish respond?
A lot of that we find that someone will come riding in going, hey, there's been cattle stolen, and then so a force will saddle up and head out from there. And that was a lot of this early part of the 18th century. That was a lot of what it was these responses to local. And by the time you're getting settlers in, you're getting people who may have been in the military, retired, or left service, and they then go out and start farming or ranching, and you start to get some movement in there. And from early part of the 18th century, the silver mines outside Chihuahua City become very important, and so there's a demand now for agricultural supplies and surplus. So the river valleys are on Hanos, and these rivers flow out of the Sierra Madre, and they used to run to the Rio Grande, but now they end right into a desert.
Yeah.
And so, but these are very, because there's water there, and so they're relatively fertile, and this is a place you can go grow crops, raise livestock, and send it to a Ciudad Chihuahua.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of what we see in the early 18th century. And so is these other agricultural establishments become established, and they do get raided. Yes, then there would be a call back out to do. And there is the Western Apache, who are related to the Chiricahua, developed a very specific set of verbiage about. There's raiding, which is, like I said, economic activity, and the Chiricahua kind of referred to it as like, oh, they're out looking around. That was a relatively low scale. 5-6 guys get together, go off and take some horses, waylay someone if they were caught, could catch them alone and go from there. That was an actual war party was more formal. And that's what I talk about in the book is what they called fierce dancing, where you would get a bunch of family groups together, get them all mobilized and headed out in the direction. And those is where you would see far more of the taking of captives because you could, if you're a 5-6 guys, you take a captive, it's really hard to make sure you can get them back.
Right. No, sure. So let's actually go through that narrative, because the chapters after two are arranged chronologically, and you talk about these different periods and what characterizes them. So the fierce dancing period is about 1750 to 1785, you say
right.
in the book. What characterizes it? What happens there?
This is a period of where both sides, we're seeing the violence increases in its scale and its scope. I think on the Chiricahua side, we're seeing again, it's hard to know, but one has suspicions. There's increasing population, increasing differentiation into the three traditional bands associated with the Chiricahua from the 19th century. And so you're seeing more people. That puts more demands. And again, there's been more growth among the Spanish settlements. There's been more agriculture. So you see larger raiding parties. You see more raids going on. And on the Spanish side, you see reforms to try to stop that, to increase the size of the garrison, to have larger and more campaigns going and preemptively going out into Apache lands and taking and trying to basically seize and stop this before the raids begin. And so that's kind of that ever upward spiral or downward spiral, as you choose to look at it, of violence that takes place in the later 18th century. And what is interesting about this is that, at least I write in the book, I mean, one of the, at least how I interpret it, I mean, I've interpreted earlier on some of this violence is about building community, getting people in. Well, some of this later violence, I think we can definitely look at it in terms of people trying to use violence to situate themselves in the community, to basically to marry. Mm-hmm. That on the Chiricahua side, you needed, it appears you needed, there was a apprenticeship period, in which you would go on four raids, not participate as a young male, but you would watch, perform camp chores, and after that you were a full-fledged male. You were eligible to marry, but to marry you needed horses mm-hmm. to give as a bride price and other goods, so you needed to go raid. And I think that's one thing we see. And on the Spanish side, you see the garrison increasing, and what's a relatively not a lot of people in the, not a lot of Spanish settlers in the area. The smallpox epidemic of the 1780s, I think Elizabeth Finn's The Great Pox, you know, it comes sweeping through. But it's able to almost, you know, triple in size because men are willing to join the garrison. And one of the reasons is that's a good way to get some status, get some access to goods, and then that gives you a better chance to get married. Mm-hmm. And we see this. Men will join the garrison, and about a year later, they will request to be married. Mm-hmm. And we see that going on. So even though this violence is going on, I think that's one of the points I make in the book, that violence can be used to do things. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it's being used to do things. It's worth the risk. It's worth going out fighting, worth risk being killed, because then you can come back and be married. And again, we're talking early modern period. This is how you become independent. You have to become married because you can't drop your laundry off. You can't go buy prepared foods. All these things about keeping a household in order, you need a wife,
right,
to do those things.
And I have to ask, because I don't remember from the book, where did these women come from? Hunt themselves, were they? Or?
And many of them were, and I find a lot of the wives are listed as natives of the Presidio.
Interesting.
Yeah, and here's the question I don't know is, you know, were these, and we're talking about relatively large extended relatives, were these women who were living elsewhere in the area who had kin at Hanos, were they going there? I mean, were women going there to get husbands?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because here's someone who has access to the supply system, you know, this is someone who can take care of, you know, can help take care of me and the same, you know, back and forth. So many of them seem to be locals. And again, that's something that our sociologists and anthropologists colleagues have pointed out, that when you're dealing in these type of border and borderland situations, this ability to do violence is looked upon very, very highly by families, because that's, you know, they need someone to, it is that protector concept that does apply. So,
but for the Spanish soldiers who were posted there, I mean, this was not considered a very good post. This was what we would call hard duty, wasn't it? I mean,
They were mainly from the local area too. They were over, it's only a few came from northern, a little farther south than northern New Spain, but most of them were from Hanos or from the neighboring communities. This is a local force. Officers, some of the NCOs might have come from Spain or you do find a few of those, but the simple fact was the Spanish realized that the horse handling skills and just the knowledge of the terrain and just the sheer endurance necessary for this post was not to be found among a lot of folks except people who live there.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of these presidios were overwhelmingly recruited from local inhabitants.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They really belonged to the locals more than anything else. Mm-hmm. There were some Spanish forces sent into Sonora and also into California and then up into Vancouver Island for a little bit. But these these Spanish forces typically had a lot of trouble with just staying healthy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They were not used to the environment, not used to the terrain.
Right. So did the Spanish ever attempt to this is probably a bad analogy, but to create a kind of final solution of the Chiricahua question? Or did the Chiricahuas ever attempt to completely wipe out the people of Janos? Or did they simply understand that they needed to keep raiding? In other words, was there anybody here who was really trying to force a solution to this problem?
Right. You see discussions like that in some of the colonial documents, but you're still dealing with this idea, okay, we know we need to... The Spanish authorities, the royal authorities, would still see these Indians as Spanish subjects.
Mm-hmm.
They're still subjects of the crown, even mm-hmm. if they're not Christian. And so there is this continual, no, we need to treat them. We need to treat them with some love of kindness. If you surrender, if they surrender, you don't kill them. You mm-hmm. you treat them with kindness. You're not supposed to take captives. That was typically ignored as much as far more than it was probably followed. So you don't see any discussions in the Spanish colonial period. You don't see any discussions like that. Among the Apaches, that is a good question. I think you were dealing with such a small size. I mean, they lived in family groups of probably no more than 10 or 20. I don't know if they even would have thought of such a thing. And if they had, I don't think they would have wanted it because mm-hmm. there was stuff they needed there. And if you're a young male, and this will become a problem, if you're a young male and you haven't done all four of your apprentice rates yet, you haven't gotten enough to get married, you don't want it to stop.
Right.
How are you going to get married?
Right.
And that does. Now, what the solution the Spanish did finally come up with was a peace policy in which they said, look, any Apache group that wants peace, we will settle. You know, near Presidio, we'll accept it and sell it. We will give them rations so they don't have to raid. And then we will go out and, with their help, attack other groups that have not yet asked for peace. And they were absolutely fine with this. It was probably the most successful from the 1780s, and it lasted well into the 1830s, really.
Didn't we just do that in Afghanistan?
Yeah, and it is an ongoing. And I think in terms of that, as your students who've been there will come back, but the Spanish essentially rented the Apaches for a generation or two.
Right. Worked in Afghanistan, at least it seemed to.
But what's fascinating about that is that, and we actually there's a guy by the name of Cordero who writes one of the first ethnographies of the Apaches in 1794, and he had been a captain at Janos in the 1780s, and so he's pretty knowledgeable about. I mean, he spent 20 years living amongst the Apaches, I mean, far more than mm-hmm. most anthropologists today do. And he was pretty well aware that, look, we can give these folks rations, but we still have to understand that they need to do violence.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to take them with us when we go on campaigns. We know they're going to do some raiding. We need to try to tamp that down as best we can.
Mm-hmm.
So both sides do this, but they're both are very wary. They're both still very carefully watching each other. They mm-hmm. know. And the violence doesn't go away. It just it drops to a certain
right. point. And so this is the period in the book,
yes,
1786 to 1830,
yes,
where they developed this policy of basically allying, or you might think of it as buying off.
Yeah, buying off. That's a good description.
Yeah, buying them off and then sending mm-hmm. them off to raid other people with the sort of
– Right.
And so the Spanish have a blind eye about this. So you should go ahead and do this.
Right. And what they do their best to prevent – And then one of the things that happens is they do ultimately say, look, okay, we're going to create a no man's land between Spanish settlements and the Apache and the Chiricahuas. You need to move so far away. If we catch you in there and you're not on your way to pick up rations, we'll attack you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so they were, and they knew that, okay, even if they're in peace here, they may be raiding over there.
Right.
So there would be continual work and messages back and forth. Hey, we got. And what's quite interesting is that, and this is where the generational split begins, is you begin to see leaders develop who are taking advantage of among the Apaches, who take advantage of this peace policy. They're older men. They're married. They begin to take advantage of this, kind of use the Spanish as cops
mm-hmm.
against their own young men, where, okay, look, they went and raided. I told them not to. The horses are here, and it's these guys. Don't do it again and take the horses back, and on you go. So... You do see some of that develop, and that's probably ultimately why this policy breaks down. Is you get a generation that's like, well, wait a minute, how do we get status? How do we come to the fore?
Talk a little bit about this next period and the breakdown of that system and what happens.
Yeah. Well, the ultimate breakdown is I think it's twofold. One is, like, to just mention there, you have this rise of these new younger men, these leaders who would, I mean, one of which we probably was, he was called Fuerte in the Spanish records. He probably, Ed Sweeney, who's done most of the work, he was definitely Mangas Coloradas, who is one of the better known Chiricahua leaders. So they're kind of itchy they don't really like this as much as they do. And at the time that they're starting to get itchy, the Spanish are running out of the ability to ration, because it's the Mexican War for Independence mm-hmm. is going on. Troops are being sent south to fight, which the men of Janos and actually the Northerners despised doing. They hated going down to fight the insurgents. It was long, and it was not the kind of work that they wanted to do. A lot of the complaints around that they lost their horses mm-hmm. whenever they went south. The rationing declines, independence comes, there's continual change of governments, and finally, basically, the rations just run out. And as the rations run out, you have the Chiricahua are now going back into doing more raiding, more that's happening. There's less and less ability to raise forces on the now Mexican side. They don't have as many resources, don't have the money, don't have the ability as the Spanish crown had. And basically, the central Mexican government looks at the northern states and says, you're basically on your own. This is your it's a local problem, you deal with it. Mm-hmm. And so every state tends to take a different approach in many cases, and so it's easy to set across. So you see this, and then, of course, as this 1820s, 1830s are happening, well, now you have Anglo-American fur trappers coming into the regions, gun traders, gun runners, this whole Santa Fe Trail. So you're seeing this period becomes one in which all the older previous means of handling problems get upset mm-hmm. and get turned over. And, again, the violence never ended. The wariness never went away. And when you start... when you're no longer getting rations, or the rations are much less, both sides get weaker and get weaker. That tends to make them more willing to strike out first, and that's a lot of what we begin to see. Is you move far more into there are raids and there are retaliations, but they appear to be. And I don't have any, I have not run any sort of regression analysis on numbers or what have mm-hmm. you. But 1830s, 1840s are definitely a period where you see far more raiding. I mean, my friend Brian DeLay, working on War of a Thousand Deserts, I mean, he picks up, at least among the Comanche and Kiowa and Southern Cheyenne, huge increases of raiding into Mexico in the 1830s, 1840s. So clearly something is going on in southwest United States, northern Mexico at the time. And so both sides typically fall. You see far more of this... like I said, of raids and revenge. And what's interesting is that these two communities are actually know each other. They're quite familiar with each other. Mm-hmm. They've lived alongside for decades now. There are Apaches who've gone to school, know how to speak and read and write Spanish. Mm-hmm. They write letters that are still in the archives. Mm-hmm. About problems. So you see this increase into raid and retaliation. As both sides go forward, both sides get weaker, both sides get more worried, therefore they're more willing to strike out before being struck, and they're without rationing, and the Apaches have ever more reason to raid, ever more reason mm-hmm, mm-hmm. To go down into Mexico.
Mm-hmm. So near the end of the book, you talk about the end game here, sort of how it all comes unraveled. How does it all end up?
The beginning of the end is the creation of a border between U.S. and Mexico and coming across the region. And by the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, 1848, the United States agrees to, it will stop Indian raids into Mexico. And the Mexicans had insisted upon this, and I'm referring back to Brian DeLay's work, that they had convinced themselves that the Indian raids were at an instigation of the United States, so the United States could then turn back around and stop the raids. Mm-hmm. into Mexico. Well, neither one was true. Americans again convinced themselves that the Mexicans hadn't been able to stop the raids because they were ineffective and inefficient.
Right.
Well, now that wasn't true either. So you do have the creation of the border. You do have this creation of the United States saying, okay, wait a minute, you can't go raid into Mexico. You have to stop that. You can't take captives. You can't do that. So this sets up that dilemma on the Apache side, is they're like, hey, wait a minute. Okay, if I go raid into Mexico, I can be attacked in Mexico, and I come back in the States, I can't keep the stuff that I want to keep. So they cross back and forth about across the border. Of course, in the 1850s, well into the 1870s, Mexico enters into a series of civil wars and resistance. There's the War of the Reform in the 1850s. The garrison of Janos quits in support of one of a pronouncement in Mexico City. And so they disappear, but the community's still there. And by this time, far more fighting was being done by armed citizens, as they called them, than by soldiers. There just weren't a lot of soldiers around. And so they're taking up responsibility for their own defense. Now, of course, we've gone from the Spanish regional view to a state view, now completely to a local community fight, almost uncoordinated with anyone else. And so anytime they can get a peace deal with the Chiricahua, Janos will take it. Anytime that they can't, okay, they won't. They will fight. And so 1860s, you have the French intervention, and of course the Mexican government has to retreat all the way up into Chihuahua, almost into the United States. And 1870s, you still have problems of finally until Porfirio Diaz finally comes in and becomes the final president for us in the 19th century. And so you have this incredibly weakening community. You don't have any sort of central organization, you have only a handful of troops. So the locals become responsible for their own defense. And this really sets up the problem where, okay, finally the United States decides after a couple of decades that the only way to stop this is to get all the Apaches and exile them to Florida. So they go into Mexico, get the final bands that are loose and moving around in Mexico, Geronimo being the primary leader of those bands. Though it's debatable how much of a leader in the Chiricahua sense he was. Take them, load them all up, and send them back to Florida, then allow them to go to Alabama, and then allow them to go to Fort Sill in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, in the early part of last century, they allow some to go back to Mescalero. But the Chiricahua never go back to their ancestral lands.
Mm-hmm.
They've never been allowed back. I think there is a case where some Chiricahua are trying to make a claim on some land in southern New Mexico. I haven't seen where that has gone forward. So that's the end of the Apache. Basically, they stop them from being a community of violence in the United States. This final exile you away.
Mm-hmm.
We'll send you completely away. And this at a time when U.S. policy was overwhelmingly to settle Indians somewhere near or around their ancestral lands.
Yeah.
On the Mexican side, you have these communities. They take defense in their own hands. This enters into their understanding of themselves. And so when the railroads arrive in northern Mexico, the Mexican government begins to, much like the United States, they fund the railroads by allowing them to basically take land along the railroad lines. Well, that means it has to be surveyed, and lands declared excess are then sold or given to the railroads to build the railroad.
Mm-hmm.
And this impacts a lot of communities that Alan Knight, who is the primary historian of the Mexican Revolution, refers to as, and Frederick Kotz also refers to as Serrano or mountaineer communities, many of which were ex-presidio communities like Janos, that when the Mexican government becomes the threat, they're like, fine, they handle it the old way. They saddle up, take their guns, and ride off and become what Alan Knight called the ideal recruits to start the Mexican Revolution. And the Mexican Revolution begins in 1910 in the north, and it's led by men who are the descendants of these armed citizens, the Janos, who are themselves the descendants of the original soldiers. But in the long run, they lose that fight and are forced into northern Chihuahua. There is some desire to take ejidio lands sizes that would work great farther in central Mexico where there's rain, but not in the north. And that's been one of the long-standing issues of land in northern Mexico. Is if you're going to run cattle, you need a certain amount of space. And if you limit people to holdings, well, now you can't run as many cattle, environmental degradation, and so forth. So it's still something of an issue in that part of Mexico.
Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting. State power finally figures out what the final solution should be. Yeah, it's a sad story.
Its strategy is to Newman, but also point out, I mean, what in some cases, looking at me, I say this because I have to work for the state. you know, what,
I didn't think about
maybe
that.
I have that viewpoint. Sorry. You know, what else could they, yeah. I mean, in some cases, right. like, well, what else are you going to do? Yeah. Are you going to allow, you know, James, it's been written about, you know, we're talking now about the Comanche, about the Southwest, but you know, James Brooks writing has said, look, it wasn't, the United States had not come into the area. You probably still have this going on today.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, you know, one of the things I often think is you can't really act morally when all you have is bad choices.
And, yes.
You know, it's really hard.
Yeah, you are dealing with the, yeah, it's the best. And there are many there, and it is a, yeah, but it, I ended up writing a tragedy, and I'm not a tragic person.
Yeah, no, I understand that, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for talking about the book today.
Sure.
It's absolutely fascinating. I really recommend that people read it. It's a terrific book about a world that is really gone. It's just entirely gone, at least in this section of the world. So, because if you go to the American Southwest today, you're not going to see any of this. So it was a world that existed in and of itself for a moment, and now it's simply vanished. So thanks for bringing it back to life, Lance. Lance, why don't you, just to conclude the interview, why don't you tell us or answer our traditional final question on New Books in History, and that is, what are you working on now other than defending the United States? Which I hope is what you're doing most of the time.
Yeah, well, on my official job side, I'm trying to get a short study out on what U.S. Northcom did to support the various states, New York and New Jersey, during Hurricane Sandy, recovery response to Hurricane Sandy.
Yeah,
that's what we're doing. On my professional academic side, I'm working on a couple of projects. One's in writing, one's in research. But on the writing case, I'm actually looking at your point of, you know, when did that Southwest disappear? I'm looking at what I think is from the U.S. side that point. That's the Civil War in the Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to basically reclaim it from the narrative of the Texan invasion of New Mexico,
right.
or from just the narrative of Kit Carson versus the Navajo.
So right,
both
right,
those are
right.
important. Try to point that 1860s is this multi-sided ethnic conflict with
mm-hmm.
Mescaleros, Apaches, Utes, Jicarillas, Anglos, Hispanos, all of whom had their own goals and desires and so forth, and how using those the framework of Carson's three campaigns against the Mescaleros, the Navajo, and the Kiowa and Comanche is kind of that cut point where that world ends.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like a terrific project, and I'm absolutely certain that it will be every bit as interesting as this book. Today we've been talking with Lance Blythe about his book, Chiricahua and Hanos, Communities of Violence in the Southwestern Borderlands, 1680 to 1880. I want to thank everybody for listening. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History, but I especially want to thank Lance for being on the show. Thanks, Lance.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.